Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here's your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Thank you, and welcome to Frankly Speaking here on the TurfNet Radio Network. I'm Frank Rossi. I'm the Associate Professor of Turfgrass Science at Cornell University, a proud member of the TurfNet Media Group that's all part of Turnstile Publications, something I've been doing with these guys for the better part of the last 20 years, and now we're doing podcasts. And Frankly Speaking is brought to you by Dry Jack Maximus and Turf Screen. And we'll be hearing from those sponsors in a minute, but our conversation today is with my old pal from British Columbia, Brian Uell, the master superintendent at Uplands Golf Club in Victoria, British Columbia. Brian has our paths have crossed a lot from my initial invitation out there at the back at the turn of the century. When I was invited out to talk about annual bluegrass, and Brian and I became fast friends, and not long after that, sent to me one of the many great graduate students that I've had, Cameron Ray. He came and did a master's with me on Brian's recommendation. We were really pleased to have Cameron here again, almost a decade ago now. And then more recently, I was really honored to write a letter of support for Brian Uell to be the superintendent of the year in Canada a number of years ago. And what I think you're going to find from listening to our conversation today is how deserving and how profound a statement it is to make a superintendent of the year out of Brian Uell with such a courageous story that we're going to talk about that started simply by getting hit in the head by a golf ball. But we are going to get to that as well as other things that our Canadian superintendents are really struggling with that might also be a harbinger of what might be heading this way in the United States with the re-registration and re-look at a lot of products. You see that Scotts recently in the United States lifted all the neonicotinoids from their lawn care insect control products. So again, a small crack. We've got another community in Maine banning the use of quote-unquote cosmetic pesticides. And more recently in Canada, the banning of the restricted use of chlorothalonil, potentially a relook at iprodione, carbaryl, thiophanate methyl. A lot of these things are being looked at again now by the PMRA in Canada. And so we're going to wander through with Brian his management of his golf course as well, a golf course that receives in excess of 60,000 rounds of golf per year. And I am pleased now to welcome my guest for today, Brian Uell, Master Superintendent, Uplands Golf Course. Brian, thanks for taking the time to join me and tell me, I know you just came through a pretty dry year up there last year in British Columbia, one of the more record dry conditions. Brian, why don't we just start out by, you know, talking about the weather, just like two old friends would do.
Hi, Frank. Thanks so much for having me on your radio station today and chatting about turf and a few other things. Yeah, we had our hottest, driest year on record in the Pacific Northwest, and definitely we saw an increase in water use, and anthracnose for some superintendents seemed to rear its ugly head and cause some difficult challenges, but we probably had one of our strongest agronomic seasons on the golf course. We just finished hosting our 14th PGA Tour Canada event, and the tour officials that were up here were just raving about the conditions, the firmness of the greens, as you know, and the playing surfaces played well.
The kind of greens that you walk on long enough, your feet start to ache. So what I noticed from looking at, your education and reading about you in preparation for this, you know, you've been at this just about as long as I have, back into the 80s. So you're well into 30 years of growing grass in one way, shape, or form that I think actually began at the Uplands Golf Club?
Yeah, I'm in my 36th year here at Uplands, so I've seen a lot of changes in the property over the years and implemented a lot of new practices, and as you've seen with my resume, definitely staying current with education and research.
Yeah, yeah. I've
been privileged to do a lot of trial work with things like Civitas or Rhapsody or Revolution, all those things before they're registered in Canada. I was one of the guys that got to give a crack at it first.
Yeah, and I think that certainly is, people are coming to you to have those conversations and have you work on those things, I think, because you add real value to sort of understanding how to use these products in Canada. But I got to tell you, certainly the more profound things that I know you've been speaking about more recently, especially on the heels of the little bit of stress you talked about with anthracnose and turf stress there. I know in the last 6 years or so, you've had an experience that you've really been very candid about. And I have to say, it's one of the things that, of all the things that, you know, can be admired of you and people that talk about mental health issues, is the courage that it takes, because oftentimes, as you know, there's stigmas associated with these things, Brian. So why don't we have time now. Let's talk about that episode back in April of 2010.
Yeah, April 14th, 2010, on a Friday after work, I went to help out a fellow golf course superintendent do some wire tracing on his irrigation system. We all know what that's like when the irrigation's not running and the stress that it brings. And we're out there for the better part of an hour doing some wire tracing, and I was about 30 yards away from a golfer hitting a drive, and I wasn't paying attention. And I took a line drive just above the temple. And it knocked me to the ground and felt a little bit dizzy. And I went home and told my wife what had happened and, you know, went to sleep that night and felt a little bit nausea and sick. And she took me to the walk-in clinic the next day, and the doctor assessed me and asked me what month it was. And I said, yeah, it's December, as I thought it was, but it was actually April. And asked me when my birthday was, and I said, I don't know when my birthday is. And then asked me the name of my children, and I didn't know the name of my kids, which was, as you can appreciate, the anxiety when you think that you should know those things, and all of a sudden they're not there. And so they sent me to the hospital and had a CT scan looking for a skull fracture, any internal bleeding in the brain, and there's nothing there. And they just said, well, you've got a concussion, and 2 to 4 weeks, you should be back to normal. But things started to progressively get worse. And what I really noticed was I do all the spray fertility and nutrient management on the property. And as I was out spraying my 13th green, I said, hey, there's some sprayer tracks here. That's strange. Somebody's already done it. I've the only guy with a sprayer, and I couldn't recall that I'd been on that green not 15 minutes ago.
So it was in fact a severe concussion where the ball hit you at the temple. You had bleeding in the brain.
It wasn't bleeding. There was definitely some massive swelling there, but most concussions are very hard to diagnose. And you know, because I continued to decline even more. I couldn't remember how to get home a few times. I had to call my wife. I was basically sleeping, you know, 12 hours a day, which I'm a 6 to 7 hour kind of guy. And we're back to the doctor, and doctor says, well, it's going to take, you know, maybe 2 to 3 months. And so we kept going through that and started feeling some anxiety and other challenges. And then one of the things I started to notice, I couldn't understand conversation. So I could watch two people talk, and I started to not understand what they're saying. And then I would go into grocery stores, and for whatever reason, I just have this massive sense of anxiety, and I'd turn around and walk right out. I couldn't even speak. And then it got to the point, I remember we were playing a dice game, and we have, you know, 5 dice in front of us, and they said, what do you got, Brian? And I looked at the dice, and I said, I don't know. And I'd lost the ability with my math skills and a lot of other challenges, and, you know, I was trying to hide it, being, you know, a typical guy. You know, you try to get back into and my wife has MS, and I try to hide my challenges at the time just so she doesn't have any further decline in her health challenges. And so I was in quite a downward spiral, and probably 5 months after that, they said, Brian, you've got a serious brain injury. And so they sent me to the brain injury clinic for 3 months to work in the brain injury clinic to try and relearn cognitive skills and coping skills. But I was really no better after that 3 months in the brain injury clinic, I'll be honest.
So what goes on? Tell me, you know, what's that like? I mean, you know you should know something, right? You know you should be able to recall something. You have a sense that you should know it, right? You recognize the question is obvious, you know, what your birthday is, what your kids' names are, you know, what's the way home. But you can't actually verbalize it because there's a short circuit.
Yeah, basically, well said. You know, after the brain injury clinic, I was still working with a neuropsychologist, and they're the one that finally figured out is I had lost the ability to filter out information. So my brain was trying to process everything at once. I'd be basically like a 286 computer trying to process Pentium information.
Right,
so
okay.
When I'd walk into a grocery store, my brain was trying to process visual, any of the colors, the music that was playing, the people talking. It was also trying to process all the color and the textures, and it would basically short circuit. So it was something as simple as a conversation. I remember walking into my family room, and my wife and daughter were talking, and I they might as well have been speaking a different language, and I couldn't understand. And I would just break into tears and anxiety, and so I'd have to go away to a quieter area. So a lot of people with, brain injuries or these types of challenges or concussions, a lot of times they don't know. Like my doctor didn't know. Yeah, I saw more doctors, Frank, over the
Yeah, I can imagine.
They just didn't know. And, almost like our industry, we're just learning so much in the last 10 years when you look at research. Well, in the brain injury end of things, same thing. They said we've learned more in the past 10 years in brain injuries than they have in the last 50. And in some cases, they've had to dispute some of the earlier research, what was happening, talking about neuroplasticity of the brain and how
right.
it repairs itself.
Right. And you're going through, I'm sure as you started to describe there, started to break down. And really, I think, you obviously had some turning points and certainly, I know from even being sick for periods of time or you get into places in all of our lives where it just feels like, it's not a demon, but it feels like a dark place. It feels like a place I can't get out of. The little bit of hopelessness, I'm assuming, had to sneak in as you're struggling with this. What's the time frame now that we're talking about here, Brian? It happened in 10. When did the hopelessness finally sort of kick in? Because this already sounds like, you're going through the ringer here with something that nobody can see, right?
Yeah, you can't put a Band-Aid on a brain injury and people with cancer or any other ailments. Well, you look fine. Well, in this case, I've met a lot of people, and I can recognize those with challenges because I've spoke about it. But a lot of times, especially people with brain injuries, they withdraw. They're kind of a subdued type look to them. They don't make eye contact. They look feared, a lot of fear in the eyes.
Huh.
And, it was after the brain injury clinic, they just said you have approximately 2 years to recover, and that's as good as it's going to get. They said that my personality would be different, and those that know me closest, would agree with that. I'm a little bit quieter, maybe reserved, or a little more withdrawn than what I used to be. And, it took, I was into it for over, I would say probably a year and a half. They had me on 4 or 5 different types of drugs, but then you're just kind of subdued, and you're so far from your former self. And, I was basically fighting a battle with myself that I was losing. I was filling out psychological evaluations every 2 weeks. And, I'll be honest with you, I was suicidal. And it had nothing to do with depression, really, at the time. In this particular case, it was just like the short circuit. I just spoke at a keynote address on this at the Atlantic Turfgrass Conference and shared with them freely the challenges, what people go through. And I just said, I have these automatic responses, no different than if you bend down or tie up your shoes or brush your teeth. You're not sitting, methodically, what are you doing one at a time? Well, I was basically going through that. I had these automatic responses where ultimately it came to a head a year and a half after my injury. My family said, Brian, you got to be honest. And I was on a Marine Scenic Tour drive with my wife and 2 kids who I love and adore, and I'm filling up the car, and they're in there joking away in the summer. And I just said, you guys want honesty? I said, if I had a lighter, I could put this gas nozzle on my head, and I could light myself on fire. And I'm not, I've got the best in the world, as Frank.
Yeah.
And this
That's
is
right.
kind of how detached I was from who my former self was. And it was, it was pretty scary.
So is that a turning point? That's got to be a turning point, right?
That would be my turning point. I basically told my wife, this is the new me. This is as good as it's going to get. And I just basically told her and phoned a friend of mine who was in the NHL, and I just said, you know, he knew I was going through some challenges, and I just said, I just don't think I can make it any further, and I'm sorry, I'm scared, I just don't know what to do. I'm single-income family, providing for my wife and two children, and trying to hide these symptoms that are just getting a hold of me, and it was pretty scary for them, and it was just what was natural for me. That's the sad part, you know.
Well, yes, and yet the sad part of then ultimately became something you've been able to, you know, I don't want to use the word recover. The word recover comes to mind, but as you said, there's still loss that parts of your personalities that might have been lost. But on the other hand, I mean, it seems to me you have a even more deeper appreciation for things because of this experience. And the thing that strikes me, Brian, is that this is one of those things, much like, I don't even want to say like managing a golf course, but you might have had an aha moment, but it's still been a long, slow, methodical improvement. You didn't all of a sudden wake up one day and say, oh, I'm 85% now, or oh, I'm 90% now. It seemed like the thing that I think is most important, especially when I talk to you and I know other people are listening, that sometimes when it comes to these brain injuries or any kind of sort of mental illness that you can't always see, these things take long periods of time to work themselves out. Unlike, you know, your leg breaks, you put it in a cast, it sits in there for 2 months, and it's likely you can go back skiing. You know what I mean? These are not the kinds of things, brain things or mental things don't fix like that. Would that be your experience with this?
Yeah, that's a great analogy, Frank, because the human body definitely has the ability to repair itself, and I'm always amazed as you talk about a broken leg maybe taking 2 to 6 months, and they told me it would take the better part of 2 years. And I know even after I had this treatment, my brain activity has gotten better and better, because I've done stories and they've hooked me up on sensors where they can measure brainwave activity in certain parts of my brain, and they've seen continued improvements on it. So the brain has a great ability to heal itself. And in this particular case, as you said, I wouldn't say it was instantaneous, but it was close to it, because, you know, the doctors in mainstream medicine, they just want to throw you into a psychologist, or they're, you know, just throwing a lot of drugs at me, and I'm just kind of subdued. And Jeff Courtnell, who had played in the NHL, who had unlimited resources to recover from his NHL career-ending hits and concussions, he just said, well, you need to try this brainwave optimization. It's a form of neurofeedback in the brain. And I was desperate, and at the time I said, sure, you know, I'm up for it. And basically what it is they hook EKG sensors up on your skull, and they measure brainwave activity in 5 or 6 different parts of your brain. And that brainwave activity goes into the computer, and it plays a series of tones and sounds and tries to refire parts of the brain that weren't working. And, you know, I was skeptical. I thought, how can this help? But honestly, after 10 treatments that I went through, this hour and a half twice a day, you know, it felt like I was back. Just that clarity. Huh. Those that had concussions or depression or whatever, you feel like you're in a fog. That fog was gone by, I went in on Monday twice a day. By Friday, it was all but gone.
And so, as you're going through this treatment, and I guess it was really fortuitous that you had a friend, you know, that had gone through this as a professional athlete, as you said, with lots of resources there. But as you're going through this and you're having these neurosensor feedback things that you're talking about, can you feel these things, or are you just sitting there and you're not really aware what's happening? It's just, you know, doing these, or is it sounds that you hear that you respond to?
Yeah, good question, Frank. Basically, what they do is they hook these sensors up, and then it measures your brainwave activity, and you can see it on the screen, these you know, little graphs going up and down, and that's your actual brainwave activity. And then the computer analyzes what frequencies are being emitted from the sensors, or what it's capturing, and brainwave activity, it'll fire a series of tones like a bass guitar or a flat piano key, or just different sounds based on your brainwave activity. So it's not a pre-recorded thing. So it's, and because I'm looking at the screen, my brain's recognizing, hey, that's me, and it starts seeing this stuff, and it starts to balance itself. So a lot of the challenges we have are brain-based, you know. So basically, I was a radio station that was out of tune, and so when I'm trying to process information, I couldn't understand it because my, the nice thing is you could go in, you get the before treatment where it shows you the actual brainwave activity, and at the end of my 10 treatments, so the before and after. And with this type of neurofeedback or this brainwave optimization, much like our industry, sometimes people don't understand it, and they, you know, they're skeptical on it. And they're just like our industry, sometimes because we don't understand it doesn't mean some of the stuff in the jugs that we spray doesn't mean that it doesn't have an impact on our turf grass ecology. And in this case, I've seen hundreds of people go through the same treatment, and people have phoned me in tears just saying that you saved my life, or my husband was going to die or check out. And, you know, so one lecture at a time or one keynote address at a time, Frank, just sharing my story and what I went through, and that there is hope, you know. And my wife and I, we've met hundreds of people, Frank, whether it's at a restaurant or a quiet place, or I always invite them up to the club and we talk quietly, and I'll even get the waitress to say, well, what was I like before when I had my brain injury to where I am now? And they would describe it, and you could see these people. They were just like me. You could see it in their eyes.
Well, they're really fortunate that of course, no one's fortunate that you had this experience. The reason we're fortunate, I think, is that you're giving us a chance to learn about it here. And I think that it is really important when people have these kinds of issues that they are open-minded to varieties of things, because as you said, and I know even in our field, there's so much more that we can learn about these things. And Brian, there's a lot more you and I are going to talk about on this fine program. We've already been at it for the better part of 20 minutes, and it feels like it was just five. So listen, we're going to take a message from our sponsor, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Master Superintendent Brian Uell from the Uplands Golf Club in Victoria, British Columbia. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back.
Golf course superintendents all agree. Traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. DryJect is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water infiltration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and immediately playable. Best of all, an independent DryJect service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. DryJect, the only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. Visit DryJect.com to locate your nearest DryJect service center. It's a fact. UVB and infrared radiation are harmful to plant health and can actually damage a plant's ability to photosynthesize properly. Turf Screen is the only product independently verified to reduce the damaging effects of solar radiation and to significantly improve turf quality, density, and health. Decrease water usage, turf stress, and wilt. Increase chlorophyll and photosynthesis. Don't be fooled by ordinary dark pigments. Give your fine turf a leg up on summer stress with Turf Screen. For research data, application information, and to find your nearest distributor, visit turfscreen.com.
Thank you, and welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm joined today with Master Superintendent Brian Uell of the Uplands Golf Club in Victoria, British Columbia, one of the, and if not my favorite places in the entire world. And I've seen much of the world, at least from a golf course perspective, and I've visited very few golf courses. If you think the story of Brian's experience with brain injury is something, I can tell you, a guy and his brother who have basically grown up on his golf course, managing it almost to what I would call perfection, in a place I would describe almost as a rainforest, with about 65,000 rounds a year. I mean, if there's anywhere possibility, I would imagine, Brian, short of frost, They got them laced up at Uplands, and they are good to go out there. So I want to turn our conversation, really, because I actually could take the entire time and continue to talk to you about your courageous experience with that stupid golf ball at the Temple. And I know it's made, I'm sure in many ways, you feel even a better person out of you. It would be hard to imagine a better superintendent with what I saw and regularly see on your golf course. So listen, talk to me a little bit, talk to everybody a little bit about the challenges at Upland Golf Club, just from a growing grass perspective. I know you've been there a long time. You got it dialed in pretty good, but you still have the same kinds of challenges over the years. Let's talk about what, I guess we could start with Brian. What's it like with 60, 65,000 rounds of golf?
Yeah, we're busy, definitely a busy golf course, Frank. We have tee times every 7 minutes. They go from 7 in the morning till 5 at night if the daylight's there. And even in the wintertime in December, we'll do 125 to 150 rounds a day. And in the summertime, we'll be approaching 300 rounds a day. So we've been as low as 62,000 rounds and as high as 78,000 rounds in my years here. So it's tough to do the practices that we need to do in order to maintain high quality POA. So it's taken some time and some skilled crew, as we've got a small crew, but definitely a very efficient crew. And that's really, just we get in when we can and do these practices. And over time, we've really evolved some good POA. You know, we opened in 1922. We've got a soil push-up greens. We can take them down to under a tenth of an inch in the summertime, and no harm, no foul. And we can produce some good conditions during the PGA Tour Canada event. We've been awarded best putting surfaces on tour last couple of years, so they seem to enjoy when they come and play here. And it's a great place to grow. But the low light situation, you know, we get 35 to 38 inches of rain. Most of it comes from, I'd say, October to March, April, and so it can be wet in the wintertime, and you still get all that traffic going through. So we need to get some good cultural practices like aeration, hydroject, planet air, good sand top dressing.
Lots of sand, right, Brian? Lots of sand.
Well, after listening to Dr. Norm Hummel's podcast, Frank, we're going to lighten that off a little bit because our organic matter is about 1.9%, so we're quite low.
I can tell you the thing that I marveled at was, you know, when I've been there, the couple of times I've been there, always a very busy place, always everyone's very pleasant. It's just part of what the allure of that part of the world is, it's a very healthy culture. It looks like a very active culture. You have a lot of people that are much older than you and I, much more active than you and I, or as active as we'd like to be, right? I mean, I've met a number of your members that, you know, got you and me by a couple of dozen years and are really at it, enjoying it. And I think what I marvel at, and I think this is where you and I first connected. When I came out there at the turn of the century, I was like, listen, man, this is the place to grow POA. And I remember back then the discussion was everybody wanted to start growing bentgrass. And I stood up in front of all you guys and I said, man, I'm telling you, I think you should be growing annual bluegrass. This looks like the place to grow annual bluegrass. And I have to tell you, I would be hard-pressed to find – I saw some good ones in Ireland, but nowhere near as firm and as true and smooth as your putting surfaces are. And there is a, you know, your good top dressing program is certainly part of that. Those things were nice and firm, and especially that you had some dry weather. They had really firmed up in the times I've gotten to visit you when you get them dry. So talk for a second, because, you know, you did go through this dry period. Let's hear from you a little bit about your watering. I know you and Dennis work hand in hand on the watering situation, and I think – water has been a common topic on the show over the last year because, you know, of the thing that happened in California and, you know, just over the bank from you in Vancouver, lots of issues with regard to water. When I was traveling in there, there were a lot of places that were struggling just having access to water. So talk for a second about the importance of irrigation and how you pay attention to it at Uplands with all that play and really rainfall only in the winter, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we'll start. Actually, it's April now, so we just started doing some spot watering on the course last week, and you know, it'll start to ramp up a little bit. But water control, we've always taken seriously. I'm sure most know that number one reason we get fired in our industry is after 2.5 years of a new irrigation installation. So we actually installed our own irrigation system in-house over 3 years. We did it in the so-called off-season here. We closed down half a hole, and we did a Rainbird decoder-based system and individual head control everywhere and dual around the greens. And so from our old system to that new one, we went from 38 million gallons down to anywhere between 18 to 22 million gallons. So we saved enough water to fill up about 26 Olympic-sized swimming pools just with having that individual head control. The other thing is, you know, I remember the old fella that I worked for. I said, "What's the toughest part of your job?" And he says, "Managing the irrigation system." I thought, well, you know, me being me back in the 80s, well, if it's dry, you turn the water on. If it's wet, you turn it down. And, and it's just not that simple, as everybody knows, because we can cause a lot of soft conditions, induce disease, cause a wide variety of challenges. So we send three people out every morning and inspect and make minor adjustments, and basically have one person on the computer who's my brother, the course superintendent here. And so he's the only guy that really has the hand on the steering wheel, so to speak. And I think that helps a lot, because a lot of times irrigation systems, people start changing nozzles or start changing programs, and you lose sight of what's in inventory in your in-ground there. And we've really kept a real tight handle on the system. So we've had great success.
And I know from visiting with you, just like you described with, you know, the hands-on, very closely monitored conditions on the golf course, you're exactly the same way with your pest management program and the way you make applications and how those choices are made. And you still, after all these years, even of being a master superintendent, are still on the spray rig on a regular basis. And I know that as I've heard you speak about it, it's really an important – it sounds like it's really key to you to just regularly get out there and see the golf course from that perspective and have that precision to make those applications. And I will tell you, as I sort of transition the conversation to something that's happening in Canada and something that I introduced in the lead, that we just heard recently that the PMRA is looking at chlorothalonil, and it appears that the use of chlorothalonil is going to be restricted to just snow mold applications in Canada. I've heard additionally that other products, potentially iprodione, carbaryl, thiophanate methyl, may also be on the hit list for the PMRA. So, you know, with those kinds of pressures pending, Brian, and I know the attention that you pay to pest management, how are you constructing some of these programs? I know from what you started out with earlier, you've done a fair amount of research with a bunch of different products, but I know it's even more than products for you. You're actually sort of taking a really close look and sort of making sure the grass is as healthy as it can be to begin with.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the greatest challenges for our industry is really how diverse our jobs are. When I started in the late 70s, early 80s, the superintendent basically focused on the golf course, where now, as you saw, I was doing a presentation the night that you guys were here, and 140 members in there. And so communication's a big part, marketing's a big part, business management, accounting, and so on. And before you know it, superintendents are spending 50% of their time in the office, if not more. And ultimately, I'm paid to grow grass, so that's why I like being out on the sprayer. I can see every tee, fairway, and putting green at 3.5 to 5 miles an hour, Frank. So I'm doing some scouting, and so I can see the wet spot, dry spots. I usually try to play golf, you know, once a week, every 2 weeks if I can, just to see it from the customer's point of view. And I think that's important, that we need to really see how's the ball landing in the fairways. We like to try and get 35 to 50 yards roll on our fairways, and the only way I can judge that is to go play it rather than drive over it. And all these things take time. So by doing that, you know, scouting and having other key personnel on the golf course, we keep a close handle, and we're more of a, I would say a curative, but we're pretty quick to see the conditions that might promote disease. Even though Canada doesn't have a lot of fungicides, and you talk about chlorothalonil and Iprodion being tugged, it looks like you can use chlorothalonil for a snow mold application once a year, and Iprodion will be probably tugged from the market. And so that'll cause some challenges. Actually, to be quite honest, I don't use much of both. My concern would be from using Dakinil. We had Doug Soldat speak a few years ago, and he said most of you don't realize how much algae you have underneath your turf canopies. And as we get into low light situations and heavy traffic, you have algae and below. Well, basically, Dakinil is about the only thing you can use to really try and keep that in check, you know, besides some of the cultural practices. So that'll be interesting to see what happens on, you know, surfaces kind of sealing off or not moving through from algae issues. But we do have other alternatives in Canada for fungicide applications. And as you know, I've been able to reduce my fungicide applications in the last 3 years with the use of Civitas and the greens, and had great success with
you've been as aggressive. Yeah, you have been as aggressive as anyone really across the golf course. And I've been sort of traveling around looking at superintendents using Civitas. And I got to tell you that it incorporating it the way you have. And I think the thing that I've appreciated is that you guys measure a lot of things. And I'm always sort of harping on superintendents, you know, let's get data, get some data in your hands, use data to make decisions. I mean, you guys are monitoring irrigation minutes. You're having to monitor your numbers of sprays and report all these, the AIs that you use. And so keeping that data there is one of the things that I think, you know, when you say you reduce your pesticide use, I know it's because you're actually measuring that stuff deliberately. Because even though I know you have some resources there, I know your course and certainly the club appreciates an efficient look at management. They like that you're very efficient with the resources that you have. And that's what I think you would say Civitas has been doing, right? It's sort of helping use your resources, whether it's fertilizer. I know you've had an experience with water. And now you just said pesticide reduction as well. So that's got to be a really good collection of benefits for you.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, you know, but I'll have to hold you accountable, though, Frank, when they said, oh, we'd like you to do some early season trial work, and I said, well, how early? Well, Frank would like to try it in February, so we did that in February, and I had three apps down at the time when we had our field day when you came out, and we started to see some, on the treated areas, we started to see increased clipping yield versus non-treated. And then, as you mentioned, some of the other stuff, one of the reasons probably why I'm asked to do a lot of product research is because I'll just introduce one new thing into the program, Frank, and I'm able to measure it and quantify it and then correlate it with weather data and everything else. So I don't have nine new things in the tank, and if it's failing, then it's the bad sun that was the problem, and if it's successful, it's a good sun that was the reason. And so in this case, whether it was Civitas or anything else I've tried, it would just be that one new product I'd try for the year. And in the case of doing the Civitas research, I think I collected about 19 pages of data, but a lot of the stuff that I found was kind of accidental, and I think we're still finding that, Frank, is, you know, when it first was brought to me, it was a biofungicide, and here, try this stuff, you know, through Marie and Syngenta, and it's like, wow, we're noticing a little seed head, turf looks healthy, and then we did some fairway trial work, and we noticed accidentally that, hey, our treated fairways are approximately 30% plus less water requirement, and then we repeated the same thing last year as well. The treated areas started to show up less water requirement, so which is great for playability. So when I have the PGA Tour event, I use Civitas here and on the greens as well as fairways and tees. But, you know, on the greens, I can really dry the greens down, and that's the biggest challenge. I ask these tour players, well, why are you guys only shooting 11 under par on a 6,400-yard golf course? And they said it's because of the firmness of the greens. Hmm. And the Civitas basically allows me to dry it down, and it doesn't check out to anthracnose and other challenges.
And you're on a regular program on your annual bluegrass greens.
Yeah, actually, I went because we had a mild winter. I actually started in January this year, Frank, and we're way ahead of the ball game. You know, honestly, in the last 3 years, so as we spoke in Toronto, as you saw, the city average was 12 to 14 apps, and then I looked pre-Civitas trial work with IntelliGrow, and we were in that, you know, 12 to 14 apps. Well, in the last 3 years, I was six applications, seven applications, and then six applications last year. So that's the only new thing that I've added to my program, so I can quantify less disease. And I check with my fellow superintendents, and they're still around that 12 to 14. But the big thing I know is, you know, we're on the tees this year, and dollar spot was huge. My treated Civitas tees, like the trial work I did, they didn't see any dollar spot, any anthracnose. They didn't see any fusarium patch till any microdokin patch till mid-November. So, so one thing I think people maybe are not aware of, that there's an accumulation effect to the product, because we started our trial work with you that you suggested, and then we had to cut it off in June because it got way too hot. And then we started again in September. But my treated areas through the whole summer, Frank, they didn't, well, my greens were bulletproof. I didn't, my last fungicide application was April last year, and then I did one in, I think, September, October. So I didn't do anything in the summer. But my Civitas treated areas, they didn't see any dollar spot when it started to show up in September versus non-treated, which just got lit up, as a lot of the golf courses did in the city. So there's an accumulation effect that even though you're not applying it, for whatever reason, the plant has changed, and the, you know, with the ISRs or induced systemic resistance, we're seeing some great benefits of it. You know,
well,
obviously,
and some of that, and I think you know, those of us that work closely are starting to work closely with it, are starting to think about the potential effects on microbial communities and the role that, you know, Civitas might have in changing some of the soil health issues potentially. But I got to tell you, Brian, we got to take a break. We're 40 minutes in and we're almost done. And I want to come back with Master Superintendent Brian Ewell. And when we return, we're going to give Brian a chance to brag a little bit about the conditions at that PGA Tour Canada event that he hosts every year up there at Uplands. This is Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi on the TurfNet Radio Network. We'll be right back with Master Superintendent Brian Ewell.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking with Master Superintendent Brian Ewell of the Uplands Golf Club. And Brian, I know you were mentioning earlier about your work with the PGA Tour Canada, and I've had my experience with the PGA Tour over the years with the Barclays at Bethpage. I know that they are a discriminating group, and so when you're recognized the way you are for that, let's start with how fast were the greens? What kinds of true firm numbers did you have in preparation for the event? How close were you cutting it? Let's talk a little bit of tournament preparation for the last 5 or 6 minutes of our time together.
Yeah, we had definitely one of our better years for the tour event. It was probably the fastest we played our fairways. We were mowing our fairways at 375.
Nice.
Greens were mowing, at 085. I know that sounds low, and I remember Tom Nicolai was calling me Mr. Low Cut in one of his seminars there. But in the Pacific Northwest, if you're not at least 0.1, you're not going to get those high tournament speeds. So PGA Tour, I just finished my conference call with them about a month ago, and usually it's about 3.5 hours, and it's nice because this is, well, like I said, I think I'm going to my 15th event this year. This conference call was only an hour, and it was nice. The feedback from the officials that were on site just told the vice president of agronomy, don't tell him to do anything, just leave him alone. So that was
right.
A good start. And then I just got contacted by the tour, and they usually come out 2 weeks before the tour event, Frank, for preparation and everything else, and to make sure that our numbers are where they are. they're actually just showing up four days before the practice round starts. So they feel comfortable, you know, what we're doing here, and they control it. They, you know, they want us to manage our moisture levels back in the day before the true firm numbers, and but now we've got moisture, we can manage that quite easily. So they really seem to focus on true firm numbers as far as playability. And as far as green speeds, they like us to be sitting around 11 feet as, you know, coming into the practice round for them, and then go about 2 inches per day as we go into the event. So we finished at around 12.2 to 12.4, which there's lots of fast golf courses, but on these 19-22 greens, it can definitely cause them some fits. True firm numbers.
Well, if you don't really know, what I noticed is if you don't really know how to play a hole, if you don't have your... I didn't play the golf course, but I got to go around it enough with you, and we spent enough time yakking that I could tell if you weren't in the right position in the fairway, those greens were so hard you couldn't really land the ball on the greens. You needed to sort of run them up to the greens. I do think your course does allow for some ground game stuff, and I know, you know, that's another thing about your membership. I was going to say, with all that golf they love to play, I'm surprised I haven't grown tired of having to give it up for a week for the tour. But I think the thing I liked about, I see when I watch your members play out there, and I know is a big part of your moisture management, is that you have a membership that enjoys to play the ground game. They seem to like the creativity that the ground game brings, which, as you know and have said already, it puts a premium on dry, firm conditions. You can't play a ground game if your ball's got chunks of mud on it, right? So that's not so easy to do in what I would call a rainforest. So are you top dressing the whole place with sand, or is it just the putting surfaces?
Well, we're top dressing the putting surfaces, obviously, throughout the year, and then top dressing our approaches. We're starting to do that a little bit more often. You know, we're a limited budget golf course as well. We have one of the smaller budgets in town, and we run about 15 and a half people in peak season that would be working a 40-hour work shift. We've got quite a small crew here, and, you know, we have over 1,100 members and a four-year wait list, and a lot of them are people that don't hit the ball a long way, so I need to make sure that ball roll is at a premium for them. So we need to really look after our customer and the playability of that. And, you know, with the true firm, that's really helped us. We do the true firm on approaches, but our greens were at 227 for final day. So I know Paul Latshaw Jr., his course at Muirfield, because I'm talking with the agronomist at the same time that Paul's is going on at Muirfield. Paul was at 312 on his final day. So, you know, we're in the ballpark with what the big players are doing, you know, on the PGA Tour, and we're pleased with that, with the staff that we've got and
yeah,
the tools that we
for
have.
Sure, Brian. Yeah. And I got to tell you, I just love it when we can have these conversations with guys like you that sort of can so articulate, you know, really nicely articulate whether it's the challenges you faced, you know, personally, or the things you've explored and adapted to over your 35 years at the club. You know, when I visited you and you gave that presentation to your membership, it was just, it's so great when a superintendent can stand up in front of membership and make fun of the members. I thought that was the best part. I'm sitting there with, you know, other people I was traveling with at the time, and I'm thinking, he's showing pictures and ranking on his members, and they're hugging him and kissing him at the end. What is it everybody else is doing wrong? And I think, not so much that everybody else is doing things wrong, but I think you've really, you know, sort of mastered the you know, you've been there so long. You really have sort of committed to that place. I think what I notice, Brian, is they have enormous amounts of trust that you're going to make decisions in the best interest of the club. You would never compromise that. I think that same message permeates your crew. You know, that you're going to make the decisions that are in the best interest of the clubs. And I think when golf superintendents can get that trust with their golfing membership, I would have to say it's really one of the things that I got to believe frees you up a little bit. As we wrap it up today, do you think that's the case, that because you think they really trust you, it sort of frees you up to try new things or be progressive as long as you keep meeting their needs?
Well, Frankie, you talk about trust. There's a great book called The Speed of Trust, and I think when you have that trust factor, then we can do things a lot quicker and more efficiently rather than having to sell, you know, sell. And that was one of the reasons why I took Toastmasters, is I have a fear of public speaking. And as you saw the night of that I had the presentation in front of a packed house there, the communication skills, they really help, right? We had a frenzy. I know I may have teased and insulted a few people, but I just told them I had a brain injury, and then that was that.
It's so great but how on you can leverage
but on,
that
on a,
there.
On a serious note, though, Frank, I know there are people listening, and they may want to talk to me. They're more than welcome to contact me through email at brianyule@telus.net or Google me, and you'll find myself on some stories written about me on that. That if anybody wanted to talk to me, what I went through, I'd be glad to talk to anybody, or even keynote address as well. I spoke at the Atlantic Turf Conference, and they said it was one of the best presentations they'd seen in 25 years for a keynote. But I, you know, whether it's one person at a time, I'll help them. Just never give up. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Brian, thanks for taking the time to join me. What a pleasure to have Master Superintendent Brian Ewell, the Master Superintendent at Uplands Golf Club, and a friend of mine I can happily say for almost the last 20 years. And really, I think just absolutely the model superintendent for many of the young people that come across him in all the classes that he teaches out there in the Pacific Northwest of Canada. And I want to thank you all for joining me on this episode of Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers in the golf turf industry, and always speaking frankly.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in. The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then, taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.